The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. And welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I am Signe Wilkinson, and my major my actual major claim to fame is knowing Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. So I'm thrilled to I'm thrilled to be here this evening. And I'm thrilled to be welcoming you to one of the author series of the Free Library Foundation, which has brought us such great literary luminaries as Joyce Carol Oates, Anna Quinlan, Garrison Keillor, and everyone's favorite, Larry Flint. So how many of you are members of the Free Library Foundation? A good showing, but could be better, and the rest of you can remedy that by signing up and sending them some money while you're standing in line waiting to have all five of the books you're buying signed this evening. And just so that you don't miss a word of tonight's presentation, please turn off your cell phones right now. We have a number of really excellent reporters in the house, and they will find out who you are and go after you. So turn them off now, and I will have to do that in a second. Thank you, Gar. So, of course, you wouldn't be here tonight if you didn't know something already about tonight's guests. Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman are investigative reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News. And they won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. In their new book, Busted, you will find out what it's like inside a drug house, a newspaper, and an FOP press conference, and you'll know at the end of the book what all three of those really feel like. You'll also find out that Wendy has a master's in journalism from Columbia University, breastfed her son until he was two, and fed her kids popsicles for breakfast. These are all things I should point out that this country's most famous investigative reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, have never done. Barbara Laker is also a mom, and her personal part of her personal life is also part of this book. Her kids, her parents, her bootlegging grandmother, and her painful divorce all figure in to making her much more sympathetic than your average reporter or cartoonist. She told me she doesn't mind chatting up drug dealers, but she does get nervous in front of crowds, so be nice to her. A friend of mine who heard them speak the other night in Washington summed up my feelings about them and this book. She wrote, "I kept thinking, where's the movie deal with this tale of two ballsy and sometimes nearly goofy broads who take on the corrupt squad amid threats from the crooked cops, the FOP, stripper junkies, and who get slapped in the face, all amid the decline of their newspaper." That pretty much sums up this book, and I can't wait for you to meet two really great reporters and great people, Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. I should say that they're going to just talk about their book for about half an hour, and then there will be questions afterwards. But of course, the first question is, who do you want to play you in the movie? Good luck.
Who do we want to... Well, I'm always afraid that... You know the woman from Poltergeist, the little woman who's like, come to the light, Carol Ann! I'm always afraid, like, if there is a movie made, that they'll pick her to play me. But she died, and I think she died a couple years ago. So that's out. But
Barbara, it's always a fun game because all our relatives and friends want to have a contest of who should play us. So it's often dinner conversation. So it's been fun. But let us start with how this whole book and series started. It started kind of in an unlikely way. A drug informant came to the newspaper, the Philadelphia Daily News, by way of a source that Wendy had at the Police Advisory Commission. And the source couldn't really help this drug informant. And so he said, you know, why don't you go talk to Wendy? Wendy had done stories on police brutality in the city of Philadelphia, and so she was the likely person to talk to. So Benny Martinez, the drug informant, came to the paper all nervous, scared to death, shaking, and he said that drug dealers wanted him dead and a police officer wanted him dead, and he wanted Wendy and I to protect him, which sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, look
funny.
At us, like, we could protect like a person maybe this high. So he starts to tell the story to Wendy about how he'd been a drug informant for a police officer named Jeff Chudik. And the way the system works is some people in the city, if they get busted for drugs, the way they try to cut a deal is they'll say, okay, I'll become an informant and I'll help the cops set people up. And so that's what Benny did. And he did it for 7 years, which is a really, really long time to be an informant. Because usually what happens is informants run out of people they can set up, and so they're only doing it for a few months, and then they're out of people. And so what happened was they kept going, setting up a lot of people, a lot of Benny's friends he set up. And then it got to the point where Benny would tell Jeff Chudik, the officer, look, I can't go make a buy. The way it works is an informant goes and makes a buy from someone while the police officer's watching, comes back and brings the drugs back to the cop, and then the cop then writes up an application for search warrant. They do the raid, and people are arrested. So what happened along the way is what Benny told us is that he would say, look, Jeff, I can't make that buy. I know this person, or he'll think I'm a snitch. And so Jeff said, okay, Benny, it's all right. Like, just these are the neighborhoods that Benny did this in and Jeff did this in are known as the Badlands, so there's drug homes everywhere. So if he couldn't make a buy one place, he said, well, just go, Jeff would say, just go make a buy from somewhere else, and we'll just write up in the search warrant that it was from that home. And so that's how that started. So the first allegation that Benny told us was that there were fabricated evidence for the search warrants. But it got deeper than that. Benny told us that he actually rented a home from Jeff, which is against police policy. You can't be an informant and rent a home from a cop, because when you're an informant, you get paid for every buy that you make. When there's a raid and they find drugs or guns, the informant gets paid money through the city. And then what happened, because he rented a house from Jeff, he would then turn over that money to Jeff in rent money. And so the whole case blew up when a big-time drug dealer in the city figured out that Benny was the snitch. Benny was the one who set him up, and he suspected it was Benny. So he hired a big-time attorney in Philly who hired an investigator and followed Benny and saw Benny go in and out of Jeff's home. And then the other big thing that happened was that Jeff decided to evict Benny, which was a huge mistake, because you go to landlord-tenant court, and it's a public court.
Right, yeah.
So we knew all about this, and so I showed up at landlord-tenant court, and it's like Benny's there, like he's real emotional, he's crying and he's sobbing, and it's like Judge Judy or something. So he's looking at Jeff, and he's saying, look, Jeff, I was like a brother to you. My kids called you Uncle Jeff, and I was your informant, and we set up all these drug dealers. Like, how could you do this to me? And I was so excited in court. I was scribbling it all down because it was evidence that they were that they had this relationship that was a rent landlord tenant relationship. And at the end of the court hearing, I went up to Jeff, who didn't have a clue who I was. I introduced myself, and he said, "Look," he said, "I'm not here as a cop. I'm here as a landlord." And I'm like, "What? Like, what's the difference? I mean, you're a cop, but you're also a landlord." He gave me his cell number, and then a big mistake. Not that he ever talked to me, but he did give me his cell number. And then, so we had a lot of things to go on, but we needed more before we ran the first story. So what we did is we pulled search warrants to find out if Benny was telling the truth about setting up these people and saying that the drugs were bought from their particular homes when they were not. And so Wendy and I went to dozens of drug dealers across the city, knocked on their doors. Some of them were locked up, so we talked to their relatives, and they were amazingly honest because they said, "Look, yeah, I sell heroin, but I sell heroin with a smiley face, not a skull, or my heroin's called Homicide, not Nike." And so with all that stuff that we got, we ran the first story, which we knew would be unpopular in the city because, I mean, drugs are a huge problem in the city, and a lot of people believe that it doesn't matter if police officers cut corners, if they're going to put drug dealers in jail, who cares? So we knew that there would be a backlash, but we weren't quite figuring out, like, we didn't quite predict what would really happen.
So from there, so like Barbara said, we knew that the police department wouldn't be happy with us. And this was also a time where an inordinate number of police officers were being killed on the streets of Philadelphia trying to protect citizens of Philadelphia. And so the atmosphere, rightly so, was very pro-cop, and police officers felt under siege. So it was a really bad time to launch a series like this. And so I have to really hand it to Michael Days and Gar Joseph, who Gar is the city editor and was the editor on the story, and Michael Days is the editor of the Daily News. I mean, they had some brass ones to back us with the story. They felt that it was important. And so like we said, So the FOP decided to have a press conference to debunk our story, and they even hired a private investigator to take apart our story, and they produced this massive report about why our story was BS and everything. And we just thought it was a press conference, you know, that they were going to stand up behind this police officer. We didn't realize that we were the subject of the press conference, and we kind of like trotted over there with our notebooks, and, you know, Gar, our editor, was like, "Well, just go cover it and just write it up. You know, they say that their officer didn't do anything wrong." So we go over there, and meanwhile, John McNesby, who's the head of the FOP, he's like the 800-pound gorilla, he's a big political force in the city, he was standing up there with all these officers behind him, and he said, he looked at us, and he pointed at us, and he said, "You know, the only thing worse than a low-life drug informant is a Daily News reporter," and everybody started cheering and clapping. All the cops were like, "Yeah!" And next thing you know, all the cameras swung around, and suddenly, like, we were the story, and they needed B-roll, like the TV channels needed B-roll, and we were like, "Oh my gosh," you know. So then Michael Days, we referred everybody for comment to our editor Michael Days, who stood behind the story and said, "I stand behind my reporters," and really went to bat for us once again. But our critics started to die down when, wait, is this my part? About the, the police officers also had a website called Dome Lights, which is now defunct, where you could register with your badge number and chat with one another. It was sort of like a listserv, but anyone can see it. So we used to just kind of watch and see what the officers were saying. And they were basically saying that they hoped that we got raped and killed, or that we got attacked and we called 911 and nobody came, or we got set on fire and they wouldn't even pee on us to put the fire out. I mean, and they called us the Slime Sisters. They dubbed us the Slime Sisters, which then Barbara and I adopted as our own, like, thing. And we started calling each other the Slime Sisters. We'd be like, "Hey, Slime Sister." We actually want to call the book the Slime Sisters, but our editor at HarperCollins was like, "No, I don't think that's a good idea." But they put my home address on the website, or in there, And I remember being kind of nervous, like a little bit nervous. Like I would go out to get my newspaper in the morning and I would like look around. First of all, I was the only one on my block to get a newspaper delivered to me. So it's not like everybody was coming out to protect me at the same time. Like, oh, you know, next door someone's getting their newspaper. So, because newspapers are really, getting them delivered is like going by way of the milkman, really. So I would go and I would like look around and then grab my paper, run back in, lock the door. And I never behaved like that before, but it was really the first time I was a little bit uneasy. Also, a couple of nights that Barbara and I worked late, we would come out of the building and there would be these SUVs and there'd be people who we thought were police officers with like FOP stickers, and they would be idling out there and looking at us and everything. And I always felt more safe than Barbara because I lived in New Jersey, and I just thought, well, anyone who's going to come over and attack me, they got to go through the Ben Franklin Bridge, and you know, there'd be like a record of that or something. And like Barbara didn't have that luxury, and I would kind of like tease her about it. So anyway, Barbara will tell you then the next part of the story.
Yeah, so after we ran the first stories, we didn't know where the series was going to go. It could have just ended there. But Wendy got a call from an attorney in Philadelphia who said that he represented a Jordanian merchant who owned a bodega in the city. And he said, you know that squad you're writing about, that narcotic squad? Well, they raided this man, this Jordanian's store, and what they did was they smashed his video surveillance cameras, cut his wires, sliced his wires, and basically looted the store. It took money, thousands of dollars, took cigarettes, batteries, and ate food while they were in the store. And so Wendy, of course, ran right over to the attorney's office to see if the Jordanian would talk to her, but he had chickened out. He didn't want to talk to her. And so Wendy came back kind of dejected. We were talking about where to go next. And we remembered that from going through all the search warrants to find these drug dealers, that we'd noticed that a number of bodegas, corner stores, mom-and-pop stores in Philadelphia had been raided by this same squad, like an inordinate amount, whereas other narcotic squads had only done maybe one in a whole year. This squad had done 20 to 30. And we thought, well, what if this Jordanian wasn't the only person who this happened to? What if there are more out there? So we scurry over to the search warrant room, and we plucked every single search warrant that this squad had raided of a store in Philadelphia. And these were all four corners of the city. They were Koreans. They were Dominicans. They were from all over the world. And they spoke different languages than we did, but we decided to track them down. And we found them, and the language was a problem. We did have a language barrier, so we got relatives of theirs to help translate. We did even charades to find out what they were saying. And all we asked them was what happened during the raid. And unbelievably so, they all told us the same story, that this squad came in to their store, about seven members of the squad. They would come in and smash their cameras, cut their wires to the video surveillance cameras, and when all the cameras went dark, and they arrested these store owners for these little Ziploc baggies that you may have seen that are used to put crack in or heroin in. And sometimes they're used in the smoke shops, and there were some smoke shops that they raided. But the law is that you're charged with a misdemeanor if you knowingly sold one of these baggies to people if they requested or if you should have known that they were going to be used for drugs. Every single merchant we talked to had no criminal record, but they all told us the exact same story with like slight differences, that this squad came in, wrecked their store, dismantled all their cameras, cut the wires, took all the merchandise on the shelves, put it on the floor. And all these were hardworking immigrants, so a lot of them dealt only in cash. They paid the rent, all their merchandise in cash, so they often had thousands of dollars. And the police officers had to fill out a property receipt, and they would say that they only got, like, confiscated $1,000 from the store when really the merchants had $6,000-$7,000, whatever, in the store. And then they ate Little Debbie's. They helped themselves to Cheez-Its. And then they locked these people up with misdemeanors charges, and all these merchants had to pay attorneys to get off. None of them had complained to anyone at all. They hadn't gone to the police because they come from countries where police often get away with doing this. And they thought this was like the street tax of living in Philadelphia. In the beginning, they didn't want to go on the record. And we had like three or four in the beginning. They didn't want to go on the record. But Wendy and I kept plugging away. And as we got up to 16 merchants for the first story, we went back to all of them and we asked them if they would go on the record that they were not alone, and every single one of them did, which we think is an extremely courageous move on their part.
Right, even the Jordanian family, they sat down with me. It was really wonderful. They invited me into their home, and they were willing to tell their story on the record with their names. And it was quite courageous.
And so that was a story. So it was called Smash and Grab, and we ran with, at the beginning, 16 merchants, and towards the end, after we ran that story, we had at least 22 merchants, store owner, bodega owners in the city of Philadelphia who said this squad had done this to them. And then after that story ran,
say one thing about the story. Our editor, Gar Joseph, who's a character in the book, everyone's a character in the book, like even Barbara and I are warts and all. You get to know us. You may like us. You may not like us in some parts. But Gar is very one of those editors who like doesn't dance around your feelings. So say you, to put it mildly, so the first story we handed in initially, he was like, this story is like a piece of crap. He actually said like way worse than that, but he's like, it goes off the rails, it's a mess, I don't even think we can print this story. And so we worked on it, we went back to the drawing board. But on this story, he would go into his office, and his office was filled with rats. We had a lot of rats and mice and stuff in our old building, and they would die in Gar's couch. He had this ratty couch in his office, and the place would just smell really gamey and everything, and it just stunk. And he would go in there, and if he was in there for a long time, then we knew the story was good and it was a go, because what he was doing was actually editing it. If he went in there and came out right away, we were like screwed. We were like, oh my god. So he went in there, and we were like, he's going in. And then he sent us an email, and it said something like, this is the best effing story I've ever read in my entire career. And we were like, yeah! Like, you know. But I mean, so then after that first story ran, we got a call. I got a call from a bodega owner named Jose Duran. And Jose Duran barely spoke any English at all. And he came from in the Dominican. He was sort of a technology whiz, and he studied technology. So his bodega was actually just wired like something out of, like, you know, a movie, you know, like, it was amazing. He had like a backup system that was downloading to his home computer at home, so we could keep an eye on his store anywhere he wanted to be. And Jose called me, and I had 5 years of Spanish. I had Spanish in high school, I had Spanish in college, and I just can't speak a word of it. Like, what the heck? Like, I just wish that I had paid more attention and took it seriously, because you really need it, you know? So the only thing I got out of him was, I have tape, and that's all I needed to hear. And he gave me his address in New Jersey. He was living in New Jersey. I went over to his place. It was late at night. He met me at the door. It was like a drug deal. He handed me the tape. I put it in my little bag, and I called Barbara, and I was like, I got the tape. And I couldn't sleep all night, like, thinking about what was on this tape, what could possibly be on this tape. And again, like, I couldn't communicate with Jose at all. Like, I tried to talk to him about it, but... So then the next day... We couldn't have done this story without really great narcotics officers who believed in what we were doing and actually risked their lives to help us tell this story. So one particular officer in the book, whose name is Ray, was in one of these elite narcotic squads, not in the same one as Jeff, but in he had a similar job in a different squad, and he was like amazing. I mean, as a reporter, you have a lot of sources that are high maintenance, like really high maintenance. And he was just like this low maintenance, laid back narcotics officer. And he was funny and easy to work with. And so He was coming over to the Daily News to watch the video with us and explain to us what was protocol, what wasn't protocol, and he was also going to identify every officer in the film. And so he was just strolls into the Daily News office. I mean, really, he could have been either fired or gotten killed for that, because he had a dangerous job locking up drug dealers. So let's say, you know, he needs backup and he calls for backup and people know that he's helping us, the police know he's helping us, then they're not going to come to help him. And he had some real fears about that. And sometimes we would exchange documents like on corners and stuff. And it was like straight out of a movie where we would just, he would just like hand it to me and pretend we didn't know each other. But anyway, so he comes into the Daily News office. And because at the Daily News, like, everything's low rent and janky and done on the fly, we could not get this videotape to play. And I was like, we tried graphics department, we tried everyone. We were like, we couldn't see what was on it. And I said, I'm so sorry. I said to this officer, I said, I'm so sorry. Like, we're going to have to go to Jose's house to actually get him to play this for us. And the officer was like, I'll come with you guys. Okay, you know. So we drove over the Ben Franklin Bridge with the police officer lying in the back seat of this PT Cruiser. And Barbara drove, because I'm a terrible, terrible driver, like beyond belief. Like, I almost got us killed coming here. Yeah. So we go over to Jose's house, we knock on the door, we say, hey, we can't get this tape to play, and this is our friend, you know. And Jose was very bright. I think the police officers thought, because he didn't speak English, like somehow he was stupid, but he was super bright, and he was like, okay, you know, I'm getting this. So he puts the tape on, he starts playing it on his computer, and right away, like, you could see these officers, especially... Like, you couldn't be a cop and not watch this video and not see that these officers were up to no good. I mean, it was just like they were looking at the cash register, then, like, looking up at the cameras, and then saying, like, whispering to one another, and there was audio with it, too, and they were saying, like, we got eyes over here. There's still eyes, like, you know. And we were asking the officer, like, is this what you're supposed to do? So there was this one really funny moment in watching the video where the police officer, the narcotics officer, goes, oh my God, these cops are in so much effing trouble. And Jose hits him and goes, I know, right? Like, I know. And it was just this weird, weird meeting of the four of us at his dining room table. And then afterwards, we all went to Applebee's and near the Cherry Hill Mall. And the food was just terrible, and the service was terrible, and there were all these kids, like, running around and screaming, and we just had a wonderful, like, night just talking about this videotape. You know, it's just, for a reporter, it's like, to have something like that in your possession, it's like a piece of gold, you know, to be, like, protected. So we finally did get it to play. And the hardest part about the video was listening to the audio and getting it correct, like what officer was saying. We ran it with a transcript. We had our lawyer. At the time, our paper was in bankruptcy. And we had one lawyer for the Philadelphia Daily News, for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com, one lawyer. And he specialized in bankruptcy law. Like, he had no idea libel law whatsoever. And, like, so he even was, like, brought down and, like, looking at the video. And we decided to blur out their faces in the video, because the officer said that we would put their lives in danger if we put their faces out to the public. But the reality is that they testified in open court in front of a room full of drug dealers, like, every day. So their argument didn't make sense, but we felt like, okay, Michael Days felt like, let's take the high road and let's blur out their faces. And so we did do that, and the video ran, and I swear so many people were looking at it in the city of Philadelphia that computers were crashing all over the city. Like, you couldn't get on it, because it was amazing. And then slowly our critics started to really quiet down a bit. And Jeff's attorney, because Jeff had hired, the FOP had hired an attorney for Jeff Chudik, who's also a character in the book, George Paquetto. He's like a former boxing commissioner, and he's just like this badass attorney. And when we met with him the first time, he was like, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to sue you guys personally. I'm going to take all your assets. Like, he was really, and he was scary, right? Like,
when he had these big overstuffed chairs and Wendy's feet didn't touch the floor.
Yeah.
So they were like swinging back and forth. And she got real mad when Baquetto said, we're going to sue you personally, sue you personally. So she took her scarf and she went like, psh, like,
yeah.
In defiance.
Right, because I had a little temper. Like, I'm like a little chihuahua, and when he was, like, threatening me, I was like, we're done here. We're done here. And, like, I couldn't even get out of this chair because my feet didn't touch the ground, you know? But after a while, like, he just waved the white flag. Like, he was like, he said to Jeff, like, I just can't help you here. Like, this has gone deeper than I'm even capable of. And, like, he stopped returning our phone calls. Like, at first it was like, we're suing you, I'm threatening you, you're this and that. And then it was just like, whatever, just write whatever, you know? So the next part of the series was...
The next part of the series, we'd heard early on that there was one of the cops on the squad was nicknamed, can you believe it, the Boob Man. And we even heard this from suburban cops from Ben Salem and other suburbs. And what our sources were telling us was that this cop, like large-breasted women, and what he would do is when he was on a raid, he would go separate the woman and to a different room, and then he would fondle their breasts, he would grope them and do worse to them and threaten them, and he was getting away with it. And so we'd heard this early on, but we were moving on the bodegas, and so we thought, you know, we've got to move to this and see if we can find out if this really is true.
But I have to jump in because the Inquirer, our big sister, we compete against each other, even though it's like stupid because we're owned by the same people, and they were trying to take the story from us at this point. And so after the first story ran, we walked into the search warrant room and all these Inquirer reporters were in there, and they had like a whole army of reporters in there, and not just like their B-list reporters, but they're really top reporters. And we were like, oh crap, I think I called you, and I'm like, the Inquirer's here. And so they were looking at search warrants with Jeff Chudik's name on it, and we were just looking for search warrants with bodegas. And so they were very, like, they did everything, like, neat and orderly. They'd put the search warrants, like, back on the stack so we would know exactly what they were looking at, and then we would take our bodega ones, and we would just shuffle them in like we were, like, playing cards or something. And then when we got to the women...
Right, we also brought our own paper because we wanted to move fast. So we took copy paper from the newspaper, brought it to the courthouse. We befriended all the clerks in the courthouse. And because regularly, if you go in there and you have to pay 25 cents per page, well, we didn't want to pay 25 cents per page, and we thought it would slow us down. So we took our own paper, we befriended the clerks, and he let us use, or all these clerks let us use.
I think
the
they thought we worked
copiers
there.
Yeah.
They thought we worked there, but meanwhile, the Inquirer was like negotiating how to pay the city of Philadelphia for the copies, and we were just like, oh, you know, we would like run downstairs, make a copy, shove it in the bag, and they were like still in negotiations, and we just got such a kick out of it, you know. Anyway,
it was fun. So anyway, on to the Boob Man. So what we had to do for this one, this is one of the most challenging parts of the series, because we didn't have names of these women, we didn't have addresses of these women, we had nothing to go on other than people had told us the name of the police officer, and we knew his badge number. So what we did is we went back to that search warrant room, and this time, instead of pulling the bodegas, what we did is we pulled hundreds upon hundreds of search warrants, because on a search warrant, it has the police officer's badge numbers, who was on the raid. And we knew his badge number, so we pulled hundreds of warrants over a two-year period, maybe two-and-a-half-year period, that showed that this officer was on the raid. That's all we knew. We didn't know if anything happened, nothing. And then Wendy and I split up the addresses, and we knocked on hundreds upon hundreds of doors trying to track these women down, or see if we could track them down if they existed. And it was very frustrating because we'd gone through hundreds. We'd spent weeks on this, and Gar was like, okay, what are you guys doing? But it was really difficult because a lot of these homes are boarded after a drug raid, and so you're going to an address, and you can't even talk to anyone. You're talking to a piece of plywood. So there was a Friday night that I'll never forget where I was on Thayer Street, and it was about 8:30, and there were four houses on this block that had been raided by this squad, and they were all boarded. And so I was giving up. I was like, just really, both Wendy and I were kind of disappointed that we hadn't gotten further on this. So I called her and said, you know, I don't know like what to do, but maybe I'll just try the neighbors of these, the people who live next to these boarded houses. I talked to a man who lived next to one of these boarded houses. His name was Angel. And he said, well, you know what? After that house next door was raided, he said a woman, he told me her name, Dagma. He said Dagma came downstairs, was sobbing, and said something horrible had really happened to her during that raid. And I said, Angel, that's the woman I need to talk to. Can you help me find her? He got on his cell phone for over an hour, dialing all these numbers, trying to help us out to find where Dagma had moved to. Eventually, about an hour had gone by, and he said, look, I got her address. And I was so excited, I called Wendy. And when each time when we were separate in this whole investigation, when we got like a tip, or we were in constant, like we'd be jumping up and down and like high-fiving and like screaming in each other's ear.
Or sometimes Barbara would call me and say she got attacked and beat up. Yeah, that, we'll tell you about that.
We'll tell you that later. But so I got the address of Dagma. I go over there, and Dagma's not home. And her cousin told me, well, Dagma's going to be home in a, like maybe an hour with her fiance. I said, is it okay if I wait outside? And she said, sure. So I'm waiting and waiting. And finally, Dagma pulls up with her fiance. Her cousin ran out of the house and went up to the car door and said, Dagma, there's a newspaper reporter here. She wants to know what happened during that raid. And Dagma got out of the car. She was like this far from me. She walked towards me, tears rolling down her face. She grabbed me, like clutched me really tightly, gave me this huge hug, and she said, I've been praying for this day. And it was one of those moments where, as a reporter, you think, this is why I went into journalism, because Dagma had told her fiance what had happened. She told neighbors what had happened. She went to the district, police district, the very night that this officer had fondled her breasts and made her feel like she thought she was going to get raped. The only reason that what happened was interrupted was another police officer downstairs who knew that he did this to women, interrupted it, came upstairs and said, are you okay up there? And so she had gone to the district, she complained, and nothing had happened until we showed up and wanted to talk to her. And then you can tell the last woman.
We had three women. We found three women. The last woman, we actually changed her name, and she was one of the very few people we gave protection, because we really believed that she was a rape victim, and usually newspapers don't name rape victims. But she said that this officer shoved his fist up her vagina so forcefully that she began to bleed, and she was really upset, and she went to the hospital that night, and they did a rape kit, and she didn't know the officer's name. She could describe him, but she didn't know who he was, but the police department knew who he was, because it was like a secret hiding in plain sight that this officer had a problem. And so they pulled Tom Tolstoy off the street that very night, and they took his clothes too, and they did DNA testing on his clothes. Now, the woman who we call Naomi in the story, she did file a complaint, but what happened was she told us that the police officers on the street, they would come and they would
pull up on her block, and there'd be like two cops in the car, and they turned her. And all these women who Tom Tolstoy allegedly assaulted, they were all very quiet, demure, polite, like not feisty, like
women. Not like me and Barbara, right? Yeah. Where we would like just beat you
kick
up.
Kick them in the chin.
Yeah.
They weren't those type of women. And so what happened was these two cops would roll up Naomi's street. They pulled her into the car and they said, if you don't take that complaint back, you'll be sorry. They kept calling her cell phone and threatening her. She had to change her cell phone all the time. She moved numerous times to try to get away and find safety. And she was scared, so scared. She told us that she could never, ever testify if it ever came to that in court because she was so scared. And she believed that she would be harmed if she spoke up.
And so she disappeared. And because Internal Affairs needed her to make a case, they put Thomas Tolstoy back on the street after a couple of months. And then that's where Barbara and I stepped in and began writing about him. And again, they took him off the street. He's still off the street, but he wants to open up a charter school for high school students who are interested in law enforcement. And he's actually in the video, and there's a picture of him in the book. And everybody in the book is gray. Like, Barbara and I aren't, we're not perfect in the book.
Or in life.
Or in life. Like Sydney said, I had a problem like saying no to my kids because I work so much. I felt guilty, so like I breastfed my kids till they were like way too old. Let's just put it that way. And you know, if they wanted candy for breakfast, whatever. But what's the point? I'm boring myself. What was the point of this?
Everyone in the book, we tried to develop their character.
Oh, right. And so Tom Tolstoy, like even Jeff Chodick, like I felt sympathy for him at points because I really felt like in some sense Benny was a real con artist and really the rental arrangement was sort of to help Benny out because Benny was like this kind of basset hound puppy that you wanted to help even though he was just a good BSer, you know what I mean? I had moments where I felt bad for Jeff Chodick, and I don't think he comes off all bad in the book. But Thomas Tolstoy, he is like, if there's a villain in this book, like, it was not, like, you know, he's like just the blackest character, you know? Oh, there was a part in the book where we decided we were going to track down every single police informant that worked with this officer. Because we thought, well, if he had one relationship with a drug informant that crossed the line, maybe he had other relationships. He was doing this with other drug informants. So we were going to track down every single one. So we found this one who we knew worked with him. Her name was Tiffany. And she was like this hellcat, like tattooed up. She had this violent criminal record. She had been arrested and charged with aggravated assault for like smashing some guy's head with a bottle, a glass bottle, and ripping his necklace off and stealing like $250 from him, and we decided we were going to go to her house to talk to her, okay? And for some reason, Barbara and I, we were always splitting up because we wanted to save time. It was all about saving time, you know? So Barbara's like, well, I'll go knock on Tiffany's door. I'm like, okay, you do that. Like, let me know how it is. And really, we, not for a second did we think that something bad was going to happen to Barbara. And so Barbara goes into this house. She knocks on Tiffany's door. Tiffany's mom answers the door. Her name's Mickey, and she's like another kind of character in the book with her coconut vodka and her menthols and stuff. And Barbara sits down on the couch, and the mom proceeds to tell Barbara, oh, yeah, my daughter is an informant with Jeff Chodick, and when she got arrested, he came over with some, like, greasy, crinkled ones to bail her out of jail so he could get her out of jail because he needed her, you know? And plus, he was just... I don't know. He was just in deep with these informants. Like, he couldn't, it's kind of like a source that you just can't get rid of, I guess. I don't know what the deal was, but he was giving money to get her bailed out. And so as Barbara's writing all of this in her notebook, and she's getting really excited because this is good shit, right? She doesn't notice that Tiffany is running down the steps towards her with her, like, hellcat hair, like, flailing out behind her. And she, like, comes up, and she just basically, she's got all these rings on. She just wallops Barbara across the face. And then, like, I mean, we're not talking, like, a bitch slap. We're talking, like, a full-on, like, assault. And she, like, slaps her this way and then this way. And Barbara's,
she told me,
like,
she was gonna
kill you, right? And she probably could and knew people who would. And then Barbara, like, knows that she needs to get her notebook because she's got good shit in it. So she goes and she, like, crouches down and she grabs the note. She gets her notebook. So now Tiffany is chasing her. And she's on the phone with Jeff while she's chasing Barbara. And Barbara's trying to dial me. And I hear all this screaming in the background. And Barbara's like, she hit me! She hit me! She hit me! And then I hear, I'm gonna kill her! And I was like, I'm in the newsroom. I stand up. I'm like, oh my God, like, who hit you? And then the phone went dead, and all the other reporters were like this, you know, like, kind of like prairie dogs. Like, they're just like, what's going on? And I was really, really, really worried about Barbara. And then she finally did call me. Like, she drove away, and she called me, and she actually couldn't figure out how to, she was so rattled, she couldn't figure out how to get back to the office.
To get to 95.
Even though she'd worked in the city for like eons. So I had to like stay on the phone with her and direct her back to the office. And when she came in, okay, so our paper was, and when she came in, she walks in the middle of a meeting, Brian Tierney, who at the time had overpaid for our paper, and our paper was just like, it was a mess, it was in bankruptcy, so he's having a meeting with the Daily News, okay, and he's explaining to us that we are going to now be an edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Like, we're going to be separate, but we're going to count our numbers, our sales numbers, with the Inquirer so that we can sell our ads for a higher price. And it was all this, like, cooking the books magic stuff. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff reporters report on. So we were, but at this point, we're, like, complicit in it. We're like, whatever, like, save our papers, you know. So Barbara comes walking in during this meeting, and, you know, Tierney's talking to all of us, and he's got this Sean Cassidy hair. It's real, you know, he's all about his hair. And Barbara comes in, and she's wearing these little, I'll never forget it, these little dainty pearl earrings that are fake, of course, because reporters have no money, fake pearls, and she's wearing like a little like peach J. Crew cardigan, and her face is just like aflamed. I could see the slap marks on her face, and I don't know what happened to me. You know how you sometimes laugh at a funeral, and it's very inappropriate? I just could feel this giggle creeping up my throat, because Barbara's just the nicest woman. Like, if you notice, like, Barbara doesn't curse. Like, I curse nonstop. Like, Newsweek did a story about us, and the guy emailed me, and he said, I stopped counting your F-bombs at 20. And and so anyway, so the bottom line is, I couldn't believe anyone would attack Barbara. Like, she's like Betty Crocker. She makes brownies for the staff and all this other. So I don't know what happened. I just started giggling. I did go get her ice, though, for her face. Yeah. And then, right. Oh, but one thing she did say, the paper never had any resources. You've heard that like a lot. And Barbara would buy her own pens. She spent her own money to buy
$3.49 for three pens at the grocery store.
They're yeah.
good pens.
They were really good, these Bic Roly pens that I would steal from her, because the paper would buy these really cheap pens that never worked. And I couldn't understand that, because we had tons of them. Like, the paper would pay tons and tons of these really crappy pens. So Barbara would buy her own, and then I would steal them from her. But after she got beat up, one thing she said to me was, Wendy, I got the notebook, but I forgot the pen. I forgot my pen in there. And I at that point, I just thought I was going to lose it. I was like, get your ass back to that house. Get that pilot pen. So anyway, I think we're like cut off, right? Yeah. We're way cut off.
So we ask that you buy a book so that they can have good pens. Very important. The way this works, folks, you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. Please wait for the mic. We have a lot of questions. We have little time. Please make your questions succinct right here in the front row.
Quick question. What's the bottom line with the cops? Disciplinary, criminal, etc.?
What's happened to them?
Is yeah,
that what your question? Okay, what's happened to them? Well, they're all five of them are on desk duty, but they're still getting paid with taxpayers' dollars. They're putting money in to collect their pension, and nothing really has happened to them. The FBI is, we don't know really what's going on with the FBI, because the FBI doesn't talk to us. But the FBI did set up a task force right after our first story, mm-hmm. and it just is in limbo, so nothing has really happened to them. And I think that's the thing that really frustrates Wendy and myself, because the thing is like, if these women, for example, were from white, suburban, rich neighborhoods, they would have been interviewed, they would have been taken seriously, and we believe the person who was accused of this would have been at least charged. But these women weren't even interviewed. Same with the merchants. They were interviewed right after our stories because we broke the stories about the bodegas. The FBI interviewed them. But they've never been called before a grand jury, and they were never re-interviewed. And Jose Duran, the merchant who had the videotape that we talked about, he ended up losing his store because he lost his lease because the landlord didn't want to rent him anymore because he'd been charged with these little baggies. So then he lost his home. He had to sell that home, and he has a smaller home, and he cuts meat at a Costco. And so the balance of justice is something that really frustrates us, and we don't really understand.
Lady in the front row here.
Just a quick aside. We used to live in University City, and there was a Catholic school at the corner that used to block the street. And one day, and I'm an OT, and I do home care, so I bring equipment. Larry was working on our buildings. This cop, an off-duty cop, stopped me and wouldn't let me go up the street before they would move the barriers. And I took it as far as I could. And the Catholic school, St. Francis, was blocking the street illegally. And we lived there since the 80s. And this went on until about a year ago. And Internal Affairs did absolutely nothing. I mean, I called and complained, had a friend at work for the city, told me what to do. And I want to know if you really think that Internal Affairs monitors, you know, their people, because I am certainly not a quiet person when it comes to stuff like that.
I think one problem we've seen with Internal Affairs is if a person complains, a citizen complains to Internal Affairs, and the police officer denies it, they don't do anything with it. And so if a police officer, unless you have witnesses, unless other people come forward, and it's really stacked against the police officer, if the police officer denies it, it's very, very difficult to get anything sustained through Internal Affairs.
Yeah, everything ends up being unsubstantiated because it's like a he said, she said. And there were these two cops who got their jobs back, and they literally were caught on camera having sex with a woman, like in a cop car in uniform, in the Navy Yard where there were cameras and stuff, and they got their jobs back. And I don't know, like, well, I think she was, but still, like, they were supposed to be working, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't do that at work. Like, but that's just amazing.
Another question. Right here on the aisle.
On August the 27th, 1995, a story broke in the Inquirer regarding police corruption. And in that article, there were five police officers charged with illegal arrests, planting drugs on people, and that kind of stuff. Also in that article, Lynn Abraham, who was running for office, said on numerous occasions that any person that was arrested due to police corruption, the cases would be overturned. As of today, all of those, and she specifically said murder cases, all of those people, if they didn't die in prison, are still in prison. The thing is that people don't say anything else. Like, this article ran, and it was a series just like yours. Nothing happened. People know that there's wrong being done, but they don't do anything about it. Have you thought of doing a story where, of those people that are still on death row, wait a minute, let me get my question. Have either of you thought about doing a follow-up on those who are still incarcerated due to police corruption?
I don't know that we've considered that story, but it's something that we would need specific cases and really be able to prove something. I mean, in this series, we were able to prove what was going on by the voices that by the people we talked to and had their voices in the paper. And I don't know that we'd be able to get that with what you're talking about.
Well, that's something we could talk about later. How about that? Because we've got to move on to the next question. Yeah, Ed, gentleman in the blue sweater here with the hat.
For decades, I've, as a reader of the Daily News, I've always considered it as a city treasure and the true newspaper of record for our city. And so I couldn't have been more proud of your accomplishments as a reader and home subscriber.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
It's just like a real personal pride I felt from the work you did and your recognition. The question I have, though, is in a city where journalism is in terrible shape and terrible danger, how do we save journalism in the city, and how do we keep reporters of your spunk and caliber in our city? I know we've lost one of you.
Well, actually, I still work at, if you're talking about me, I still work at the Daily News. I did spend a year at the New York Times covering police officers and the stop and frisk issue and all that. But I came back to the Daily News, and Barbara and I are working together. When I left, we had 30 reporters, I think, and now we have something like 16 reporters left, and it's really tough. And some of the reporters, Stephanie Farr is here. She writes like a zillion stories a day and frees us up to run around on more in-depth stories. And we're very appreciative to everyone at the Daily News, because it's like, I don't even know how the hell the paper comes out every day. It's like, I pick it up and I'm like, how'd that happen, you know? Especially since I had nothing to do with it usually. Stephanie, like, wrote all the stories. But, I don't know. We don't know how to make money. Like, every person who stepped in to buy our paper, and we're going to be up for auction for the sixth time in 8 years we could possibly have new ownership, or we're not sure what's going to happen. They all have the hubris to think that they can fix this problem, that we can figure out how to get people to buy newspapers and pay for news. And we're counting on their hubris. Like, we were actually rooting for Brian Tierney. And even when George Norcross bought the paper, he called me on the phone because we had been enemies. Like, he didn't like me at all. And now he owned the paper. And we got into it a little, and he called me to talk to me. And he's like, I want to tell you, I am not going to fail. I don't fail. I don't know how to fail. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, good. Like, I'm glad you don't know how to fail, because help us figure this out. Because, I mean, we've opened up Pandora's box. Everybody thinks that news is free. And the news that you're reading comes from reporters, but you're reading it on the internet, and you don't want to pay for it. I sometimes think about canceling my subscription, because I've already read everything like on my Twitter account by the time I get into work. And I would never do that, because it would be like blasphemy. I can't even imagine not doing that. I think the world would go dark if that happened. But I'll spend like $5 on a latte at Starbucks and wait in line for a really long time at Starbucks. But I see people don't want to pay for news, and so we don't know how to make the business model work. And it's scary. It's a thrilling time in journalism, especially for young people who are nimble and can work for cheap and are hungry. But for people like us, like, I don't know, I'm like middle aged, really am. Like, I don't know what's gonna happen. So. Mm-hmm.
Another question. Right here in the front row, and then we'll move to the back.
To go further with what the gentleman said, first, thank you for your hard work and your dedication. Like Ben Franklin said, without a free press, we're going to have corruption and lose our democracy. I do think this city is at a tipping point, because I've run into, in my personal life, stuff like you're talking about, where the people that are committing the crimes are so blatant, because they're pretty sure even if they are caught, nothing's going to happen to them. So it's almost like the Keystone Cops that you're up against. And it's just...
Sir, do you have a specific question you'd like to ask?
Well, I just wanted to thank them for their thing, and I also wanted to ask them what they thought about how to, generate something in that, you need to have advertising revenue to pay your salary. And it is a sticky question, but maybe journalism shouldn't be thought of as a for-profit industry like it used to be. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think they're in accord. Right on your left there, Paula.
I was just wondering, after having, covered this story, has it changed your opinion on the subject of drug legalization? Are you more, I guess, open to that sort of viewpoint now?
I do.
No, go ahead. Oh, no, you could go ahead.
I do think it changed my view of the drug war and what needs to be done. I think that a lot of time is sometimes spent on small-time drug buys, and it does nothing in this city at all. It just puts more people in prison. I mean, if you're going to bust someone for a small amount of pot, like, what's the point? You're just putting all these people in prison, and you create a real distrust, and it rocks the whole relationship between police officers and people in the community.
Yeah.
And if more effort was put into the... I think more effort should be put into getting guns off the street. And a lot of these guns are related to drugs, the guns definitely that are the problem.
But I also want to say, I'd like to point out, too, that Barbara and I are not cop haters. We couldn't have done this series without really great police officers behind us, and they really have an important job. They really put their lives on the line, and some of the police, I have a lot of respect for them. But I will say this, with narcotics, I think that the reason why you see such theft, like a problem among the narcotics units, is because they get so frustrated. Imagine being sent out day after day onto the streets of Philadelphia, and you're arresting the same people, and it's this revolving door justice system, and you see these drug dealers with all this money, and you just feel like, I can see, I'm not saying I agree, obviously I don't agree with it. I'm just saying that I can see why police officers in narcotics would just become so frustrated with the war on drugs. It would just wear them down, and they would feel like, I'm just going to take this money from this drug dealer because this whole thing is a joke, you know?
Question over here on our right.
Can you say some things about what impact you believe that the kind of work that you're doing actually is having on the underlying corruption?
Well, the problem is that nothing's happened to these officers and the people haven't been interviewed. And so because of that, like, we kind of wonder, well, what impact did it have? I mean, it's frustrating for us that nothing has really happened. And in some areas, especially like in the 25th District, I mean, we heard the FBI was watching these two police officers who they believed were corrupt, that they were stealing from drug dealers and people in the neighborhood. So they're on a stakeout watching for these two cops, and lo and behold, they see two different cops do the exact same thing. And so obviously it's like a problem that I think does exist in especially in certain pockets of the city. And we're at a loss for words why nothing has been
done. I think it's a loss of leadership in the cities. And sometimes I just think we need, I'm not saying anything against the mayor or Commissioner Ramsey. I'm just saying that it comes from the top. You know, you need someone tough at the top. Someone who doesn't tolerate corruption at all levels of government. It just can't be tolerated. And I do notice that Barbara and I, we're working on a series now about Social Security fraud, and we don't get as many phone calls about it, or we don't feel like, I don't know, the same reader reaction.
Got time for one more question. Gentleman right in the middle here. Sir, if you wait for the mic, it's coming right to you. Gentleman in the middle.
It seems almost ironic that it's 30 years plus past the time when the journalist Akeek, both from a national and local level, came down on the impunity that existed within the negative elements of the Philadelphia Police Department under Frank Rizzo's, in Frank Rizzo's year. Here we are 30 years later, and we're dealing with the exact same thing, and impunity still exists for these negative bad apples. Do you see the culture at all changing? Will something very positive come out of this for the future, such that we will not have these stories in generations to come?
Well, I do think Commissioner Ramsey has done a good job of, when he does hear of a corrupt cop or a bad apple, he has fired them and he's taken action. The problem that he says is happening is that the police officer can go through arbitration and fight for his job back, and almost always gets his job back. There was a police officer Wendy and I wrote about who was outwardly stealing from people in the neighborhood. He was even on videotape stealing from people and had to give the money back. And then he was fired, but he got his job back, and he's now in the 22nd district. So if you ask Commissioner Ramsey, the problem is the whole arbitration system in this city that they are able to get their jobs back.
I think I don't quite understand the FOP's thinking, and like they will back officers no matter what, go to the mat for officers. And I just don't think journalists are like that. If I know a journalist is making up stories or like, you know, I just want to light, I just want to light them up and be like, this guy's bad. You know, we got to get rid of him because he's going to erode our industry, because all we have is our brand and all we have is the trust of our readers. And if we have one person destroying that, it destroys the whole thing. So, you know, I don't know. But to answer your question, like, we didn't think we were going to win a Pulitzer for police corruption because Bill Marimo, who runs the Inquirer, had won not one but two Pulitzers on stories about police corruption. And so we were, like, thinking, like, we weren't going after a Pulitzer because we were thinking, like, is this news? Like, you know, corruption, cops taking money, is this news, you know? So we were amazed. I don't know if that answers your question.
And that's where we have to leave it. Please join me in thanking Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.